What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at WeightWatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast, brought to you by The Nation Magazine. I'm Dave Zirin. We've got a great show for you this week. We are going to speak to Maya Goldberg-Safer, who writes the WNBA blog WNBA Rough Notes, to speak about the incredibly important and historic labor agreement that just took place between the WNBA union of its players and WNBA management. Maya's going to break it all down, and I'm so glad she's going to be here. Also, I've got some choice words to tell you about my night with the mayor and Muhammad, where I sat down with Mayor Zoran Mamdani and New York Knicks player Muhammad Diawara. We're going to get to that in just a second, but first, Maya Goldberg-Safer. So first and foremost, this deal. What are the basic parameters of what the union signed for, and what are your initial thoughts?
Yeah, so I guess off the bat, so this is, we know that they have a verbal agreement, the players and the league, right? So that's huge. I do think that it's going to stick, right? They're talking to the press, they're on Good Morning America. Everyone on both sides seems to really want a WNBA season, which is its 30th season. So a historic season with two new expansion franchises in Toronto and Portland. So I think I think we're headed for a season. At the same time, we haven't seen the terms hammered out in writing. So there are still some unknowns, and we're sort of relying on what they're saying about the agreement. But let's see, to me, one of the biggest things is that this is a huge sort of economic leap for the entire league. So we are looking at the lowest salaries in this new CBA still being higher than the highest salaries in the old CBA.
Wow.
Yep.
So, and to put some numbers on that, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the peak salary you could get last year was $220,000. Is that it?
Something like that. A little more, I think.
A little more.
And now we're going to have a base of 270 for the lowest paid players.
Amazing. And last year, the base for the lowest players was about 66 grand. Is that right?
Yeah, something like that. And so we're also looking at rookies going from making in the 70s, like 76K, let's say, for that's how much Paige Bueckers made last year. There's apparently some provisions that expedite the process for star players, star players to get these higher salaries. So, she's going to be now looking at something that's more in the 500,000, 600,000 range. And then top rookies coming in are also going to be making, around the same.
Amazing. You know, I'm hearing some people describe this as a slam dunk victory. for the players because of the salary raises that you're talking about. And I hear other people say, well, wait a minute, it's still just going to be 20% of the revenue that they're getting, which is way behind the equity that was always talked about in terms of the way the NBA basically does a 50-50 kind of operation. Well, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, totally. I have a lot of thoughts about it. I think that it, and I'm still kind of processing it because I'm kind of surprised by how sort of elated I am for the women of the WNBA that they did get this deal and that they really stuck their ground during negotiations, right? Like the WNBA, and I kind of think about it as like the W in parentheses NBA because we know that the NBA and NBA owners own the majority of the WNBA. They own 42% outright, and then there are owners who own both WNBA and NBA teams. So, I just think that they're, or the sorry, the NBA and WNBA really like threw everything they could right at this process to try to deter the players. They set these sort of arbitrary deadlines, right? We had 100 hours of negotiations. They sort of control the media narrative. And so the fact that they got what they got, that now for the first time, WNBA players are going to be able to make over $1 million, that, right, the entire league is taking such a pay raise. It is remarkable. And it also is coming up against decades and decades of, and I think I can curse on this podcast, right?
Cuss away.
Amazing. Of women's basketball players really getting fucked by men who are in charge, getting fucked financially by men who are in charge. And so, in some ways, it is like the women are getting fucked a little bit less by this deal, right? Like, it's, you turn it around, and you're like, this is the first time that women in the WNBA can make over $1 million. Like, if you think of $1 million in a lot of pro sports as sort of this, breaking through to, being a millionaire, let's say. Like, it's just insane to me that they haven't yet, the best players haven't made $1 million. And I think that, we're looking at such inequality between women's basketball players and their male counterparts that, right, it is a longer fight. This is not the last CBA negotiation where there will be an absolute dogfight between the players and the league. And it's true. The players started with proposing 40% of gross league revenue that they would get, and we're down to 20%. So they have, in that sense, if you think about it, and the economist David Berry, who writes a bunch about the WNBA and NBA, I really like what he has to say, points out that's giving back hundreds of millions of dollars to the NBA in the next, in the coming years, or around gross revenue, the fact that they went from 40 to 20%. So I think there are all these different ways to look at it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. What in my opinion, what do you think the effects would have been if there had been a strike to start the season? Like what do you think that would have done for women's basketball, especially coming off an unprecedented year of popularity?
Yeah, of course, there is part of me that was certainly like, come on, let's go, let's get serious, like let's do something that is just like labor-wise would be really exciting in terms of sort of like a move in labor history. But also I think it would have gotten really messy. It is clear to me that sort of even though the WNBA did authorize a strike when necessary some months ago, there have been some comments from people high up in the Players Association that were kind of wishy-washy about a strike. And it feels like neither side really did want a strike. Again, 30th season, two expansion teams, people really seemed like they wanted to play. And I do think also that it's really hard to gain leverage even with a strike when the reality is that there are still a number of folks, and we don't know who they are because we never really hear like the management side, the owner side, like dissected. It's sort of like a black box. We don't really know what's going on, but historically and culturally, there are many people on the NBA side to whom, for whom the WNBA is a cost, not an investment. So they don't really even care enough, right, about the overall amount of money that the WNBA is making, which is more than it has, you know, ever made before, but is still, you know, not matching the tens of billions of dollars that the NBA makes, then I think it can be hard to negotiate even with a strike, and definitely jeopardizes the momentum that that they've been building.
But do you think there were fissures in the union and their approach to this? Do you think that it was much more of like a solid solidarity situation? And do you think if there were fissures that may have hampered the quality of this deal, which, like you said, it looks like a great deal, but you know, the question lingers.
That's a good question. I mean, I don't think we really know the answer yet. You know, I think that the coverage right around the end of negotiations just gets so wonky. And so, yes, there had been definitely commentary about, you know, fissures within the players union, but it's also like, where and why is that, you know, coming from? And I guess my guess is that there is not necessarily total solidarity around a strike for some of the reasons that I was just talking about, because I think it feels so messy, and there's never been a strike in the WNBA. And, you know, there has long sort of been a culture of WNBA players, women's basketball players, you know, making these sacrifices and taking on a lot of this responsibility of holding up a league, you know, way back in the day. In 2002, David Stern, who was leading the negotiations at the time, threatened to fold the WNBA if there was a strike. So that's kind of been, I think, deeply ingrained culturally in the identity of the WNBA. And so I'm curious about that, and I'm not sure. But my guess kind of out of left field is that there might not be total alignment around a strike. And I wonder if that will change in the future. I also wonder what it will be like if the WNBPA, the Players Association, ends up involving fans even more, because I do think the WNBA fans are overwhelmingly behind the players in terms of this labor battle, you know, want these conditions, the pay, the infrastructure, to keep getting better and better for the women.
Now, what about fan support? This is something you and I spoke about previously, and I just think it's fascinating, because usually when you have these labor battles in the world of sports, fans tend to push back, and largely male fans tend to push back against the male athletic counterparts and side with ownership. But this feels like a very different dynamic. And how would you describe the fan base of the WNBA and where they sided in this process?
Yeah, totally. So, right, I do think that the fans are much more aligned with the players on these issues, at least this time. And if you look back, Nafisa Collier had this exit interview at the end of the WNBA season, right, where she sort of interrupted the traditional exit interview and called out WNBA management. And she said, you know, coming up on this negotiation, you know, basically she was sort of calling them out. She said that the W has the best fans in the world, the best players in the world, but the worst leadership in the world. So that really puts fans and players sort of on the same side. And, you know, after the WNBA All-Star game this last season, when the players wore shirts that, you know, pay the players shirts, pay us what you owe us, like, fans were wearing those shirts to games, bringing signs. And, you know, that was still months away from the end of negotiations. I think during the WNBA offseason, when most of the negotiating really took place, there has been a little bit of sort of confusion from fans of like, what do we do if there's not a season, or should we be buying our season tickets now? And I'm curious about what it could look like in the future if there was more sort of direction directly from the union to fans in terms of how they can support. So that's something to keep an eye on in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Look, you've been really generous with your time. Is there anything else you want to say about this battle? First of all, who are the heroes in your mind on the women's side of things, like in terms of the union leadership? Who to you really stepped up?
Yeah, I mean the people that we're really sort of seeing, the faces that we're seeing are Nneka Ogumike. We're seeing Breonna Stewart, Nafisa Collier, Alicia Clark, Breonna Turner. And we are, let's see. I mean, I always go back to the OGs and like the women who were building this, you know, decades and decades ago. I think that they are owed a ton of respect, appreciation. And they have also, one thing that's been true in the WNBA up until now is that players have never gotten pensions. So there's mention of there being retirement benefits. We don't know the details yet. And there's been mention that there will be a show of appreciation for the WNBA players who started it all, whose, you know, shoulders we stand on. So I'm really looking forward to learning more about what's going on there.
Awesome. Now I'll ask you the question. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Oh, my bad.
No. I backtracked on it. What else do you really want people to know about this deal?
What else? Honestly, I kind of feel like we covered a good amount.
We did cover a good amount. Do you trust ownership in the WNBA?
No,
do you
of trust course Kathy I don't Engelbert? Trust ownership.
Give us the reasons. What is it about their tactics during this process that you find unpalatable?
Yeah. I think that the thing about ownership is that they are not really losers in some ways in this. I think in the arc of history, this points in a direction of management and ownership losing more. So that's important. That's significant, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are these 30 NBA owners, right? Who make up the majority of control of the WNBA, who are set to profit off of the league when they might still not have any kind of role, like, you know, vested interest or sort of fundamental belief in women. Like we, and so the fact is that I think that they're really self-interested, perhaps even more than a sort of typical pro sports owner, because some of them fundamentally like don't believe in the product. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be really dangerous.
Definitely. This has been awesome, Maya. How can people keep up with your work?
Yeah, totally. So you can follow, you can subscribe to WNBA Rough Notes. It is on Substack. I'm also on Instagram at roughnotes.mgs. And you can look out for my name when I freelance around. I've been writing some pieces for Defector about women's basketball players in history that you should definitely check out.
Ooh, very cool. Defector is an amazing site. Everybody should check that out. This is the Edge of Sports podcast brought to you by The Nation Magazine. I'm Dave Zirin. We'll be back right after this. We'll be back right after this, but first, a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. Okay, look, the need for independent journalism has never been more important, and The Nation brings it each and every week like they've been doing since 1865. I'm serious. This is what you gotta read. It's The Nation Magazine. Go to thenation.com/subscribe, and please never forget that when you support The Nation Magazine, you are also supporting the continued existence of this podcast. So please subscribe. Go to www.thenation.com/subscribe. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. Thank you so much to Maya Goldberg-Safer. Thank you so much to everybody in the WNBA Players Association who hung tough and showed us that solidarity truly is the only way to win. And now I got some choice words about my time with the mayor and Muhammad. A couple Saturdays ago, Muhammad Diawara, the 20-year-old rookie for the New York Knicks, sat down with 34-year-old New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani for iftar. Iftar is one of the most spiritually significant meals in Islam. Each night it breaks the dawn to dusk fast during the holy month of Ramadan. Over plates of steaming chicken, lamb, and fish at a 12-table Senegalese restaurant in Harlem called St. Louis Restaurant Kur Yayu Dara, two of the city's most prominent Muslims broke their fast together. In a country awash in anti-Islamic bigotry, where a GOP member of Congress just posted that Muslims don't belong in American society and not a single member of his own party condemned his words, and amid the U.S. and Israeli war on Iran, Diawara and Mamdani's iftar meal was a political act, even if it did not announce itself as such. It was a celebration of not just religion, but visibility. Given the incredible challenges progressive and radical movements face, representation and visibility just won't be enough. But in the face of state erasure, that's both political and violently physical, it remains a necessity. I was sharing earlier with Mo, Mamdani said, that it means so much to so many young Muslim kids to know that someone on the team we love is fasting in the same way. Diawara, who turned pro in Paris at just 17 years old, has a maturity and sense of self that belies the fact that he was born in 2005. He is aware of his status as a Muslim, an immigrant from France, and a Nick. Living in the United States, he quickly learned that young fans would be looking up to him and understood that he would be a role model. And as a New Yorker, Diawara was excited to meet the mayor. And as for Mamdani, dining with a member of the Knicks was clearly a thrill. What's so exciting is that we're seeing one of the strongest Knicks teams in a long time, he said, his voice animated. When the Knicks do well, you can feel it in a way you can't quite describe. You know when it was 70 degrees the other day? That's how it feels when the Knicks do well. People are happier, more excited. I remember during Linsanity, which by the way was the time when Jeremy Lin, another Knick, went on a one-month jag of greatness in 2012. I was watching the games on my phone in college and in class. That's what it feels like right now. That feeling of excitement is what I want every New Yorker to feel like every day. When both were asked whether it's more difficult to run City Hall or play NBA basketball while fasting, the mayor quickly responded, being a Knick. But Diawara disagreed. Fasting didn't make playing more difficult. Quote, it's really not hard at all because I know why I'm doing it and I know the strength of my religion, he said. With fasting comes focus, clarity, and makes me feel closer to God, end quote. It also helped that the Knicks organization and his teammates had been, as Diawara reported, extremely supportive throughout Ramadan and the fasting. If you're in a job where you're talking all the time, you feel the lack of water even more than food, Mamdani added. But this isn't something we are being forced to do. This is something I look forward to. Because with the fast comes, as Mo said, a focus and also comes reflection. After eating, the 5'11 mayor and the 6'9 Nick walked 9 blocks to the famed Marcus Garvey courts. The mayor's trademark rapid steps kept up with Diawara's broad strides as security and mayoral aides gulped air trying to catch up. Mamdani has faced vocal critics from the right, most recently for sharing an iftar dinner with former Columbia activist turned political prisoner Mahmoud Khalil, and the left. But as we walked down Lenox Avenue that evening, people on the streets shouted encouragement. A group of men outside a bodega cheered. After one bystander took a selfie with the mayor, he looked up at Diawara and said, you play for the Knicks, right? In a time when politics feels like a place where hope goes to die, it was striking to see a Muslim democratic socialist being effusively supported in the city's streets. This excitement transcends his mayorality and his policies and speaks to how New York City feels in having elected someone much of the country and both political parties would have deemed unelectable. And in doing so, the joy of giving a resounding rejoinder to the country's anti-Muslim bigots. On these corners, on this night, Mamdani's election was a point of pride. Now at the courts, Diawara and Mamdani hoisted a few shots with some locals out in the chill for some hoops. The Garvey courts are lit up at night, and all the 6 baskets were occupied. The city game was well represented. Most players were too into their games to even notice the mayor and the Nick, who were, let's just call them Zoe and Mo. They didn't even notice them. But one group took up the mayor's invitation to play horse. And still in a tie and dress shoes, the mayor took his shots with mixed results. But credit to him for being game and having fun, the smile was affixed, swish or brick. When Diawara won the game, the 3 other players said they hoped it was a good omen for the Knicks entering the stretch run of the season. Okay, look, from the beginning of his second term, Trump has tried to bend the men's sports world to his influence. From football to the Olympics to the World Cup to the world of mixed martial arts, little has escaped his greasy grasp. Together with his attacks on media and education, it's clear that his regime is engaging in a hostile takeover of cultural spaces where ideas rooted in resistance like the embrace of Black Lives Matter, the fight for women's rights, the intervention into electoral races, and the initial inclusion of transgender athletes held sway just a few years ago. Diawara and Mamdani's evening together showed that these ideas are still powerful. At dinner, Mamdani had touched on the role of athletes in such a dire current climate. He said, "When athletes speak the truth, it carries a different kind of resonance. Growing up and having these incredible figures who you admire not only for their athletic ability, but precision of their intellectual analysis of the world around them, it matters." Many of the country's most outspoken athletes have also been Muslims. Muhammad Ali, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf and Diawara is well aware of that tradition and draws upon the pride that comes with it. Saturday was a night of hoops and heritage. Two Muslim New Yorkers celebrated a holy meal together as the city cheered on their team and an election. It was also a rebuke to all those people telling us whom we can love and whom we should hate. Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you so much to Maya Goldberg-Safer for her insight into the WNBA labor agreement. Thank you so much to everybody out there listening. Thank you to my producer, David Tigaboo. And thank you, of course, to The Nation magazine. Everybody, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.